First Kings chapter 20, if you have your Bible this morning, and we're continuing looking at this book. But today the focus shifts slightly from looking at Elijah. In fact, Elijah is not mentioned in this section. And it records an incident between two ungodly kings, two wicked kings. A man called Ben-Hadad. Ben means son. Hadad was a Syrian god. So it's a title of a king of Syria that was passed down from king to king, like Pharaoh was passed from different pharaohs. So Ben-Hadad means the son of Hadad, or the son of the god. And the Syrians were a nation like today. I'm sure you're familiar with the name Syria, and you'll see it on the map behind me. The nation of Syria was a nation that was right next door to the nation of Israel. And if you see on your map there, you will see that it's right beside one another, to the northeast of the nation of Israel. Now, Ben-Hadad was a very powerful king at this time in history. And he had a gathering of 32 kings that were under him, that he had conquered. He had a kind of mini little empire that he controlled over the Middle East. And Ben-Hadad decided he would march down and take some things that he could see in the nation of Israel. Ahab had become rich and prosperous and powerful in the nation of Israel. And Ben-Hadad looked over the border with a green eye, and he decided, I'll head down there and I'll help myself to what I see. Now, under the godly King David, and later under Solomon, Israel was a very powerful nation. Israel was a superpower at that time. But at this point in history, Israel was greatly weakened, particularly after 3.5 years of famine and drought in the land. And Ben-Hadad saw an opportunity to take advantage of the weakness of Ahab. And when a country or a company or even an individual is weak or perceived to be weak, there are always predators who are out to steal your lunch. That's what history tells us. And if you look around, you'll see example after example of this. And Ben-Hadad sees an opportunity. Now he marches down to the border, to the capital city of Samaria, invades the territory of Israel. And the odds are very heavily stacked in his favor. We know from later on in this chapter, he has at least 127,000 troops, including many chariots, which were like the tanks of that time. By contrast, after the famine and the economic devastation that had hit the nation of Israel, Ahab was left with just 7,000 troops to fight against at least 127,000. So it didn't look good for Ahab, and it didn't look good for the nation of Israel. And when Ben-Hadad reached Samaria, he did what many kings at that time do. Before they launch a war, they launch an attack, they offer terms of surrender. And they say, if you surrender and pay X amount, we will not attack you. We'll walk away and leave you as a tributary nation of ours. And he makes his first offer. He says in verse 3, after he besieged Samaria, he sends these messengers, thy silver and thy gold is mine. Thy wives also and thy children, even the goodliest, are mine. And straight away you see the pronouns used here. Mine, it's all mine. Here's a man full of himself, puffed up with pride. Here's a man who has no regard for God, no regard for providence. He just looks at everything in life and says, this belongs to me. It's all mine, mine, mine. Fully self-centered individual, proud individual, no regard for God in his thoughts or his words. And Ahab hears the offer. And verse 4, you see his response. Now, whenever you see Ahab responding, always ask yourself this question: how does he not respond first? As well as, how does he respond? Because you'll notice in the language he uses all the way through here, Ahab has no mention of God in his thoughts. No mention of seeking God. Now, he has Elijah and Elisha. He has the prophets of the Lord that were hid by Obadiah. He has many opportunities to seek the help of God. But straight away, when the crisis comes, when the trouble comes, the only thing Ahab can think of is how to solve this by my own wisdom, by my own ingenuity, and how to save my own skin. And he doesn't consult God. In fact, he doesn't consult anybody. He just decides, I'll respond. And he does. And he says in verse 4, my Lord, O King. Well, very hard for Ahab to say that to another king. Call him his Lord and his King. But he has to, because he's afraid of losing his position and his power and his possessions. And he says, my Lord, O King, according to thy saying, I am thine and all that I have. Now, you notice this man, it's almost amusing, Ben-Hadad says, your wives are mine. And who was the wife of Ahab? Jezebel. You don't see Ahab too concerned about her. In fact, you almost see the sense that he's hoping to get rid of her. He sees an opportunity to get rid of her as his wife, a troublesome one. And as soon as Ben-Hadad says, your wives are mine, your wife is mine, he says, well, help yourself. Please take her. Saves me a divorce. And Ben-Hadad, he spots another thing in Ahab. He spots the quickness of his response indicates his weakness. Weakness of his position, weakness of his character. And Ben-Hadad in verse 5 makes a second demand. He says to himself, well, I should have asked for more. This man is so weak, so pathetic, so hopeless, his situation, that I might as well have it all. Why take 90% when I'm going to have 100%? And Ben-Hadad sends the messengers down, verse 5, the second time. And he says, I have sent unto thee, saying, thou shalt deliver me thy silver and thy gold, thy wives and thy children. That's his first demand. He says, okay, I'm taking that. But then verse 6, he says, yet I will send my servants unto thee tomorrow, about this time, and they shall search thine house and the houses of thy servants, and it shall be that whatsoever is pleasant in thine eyes, they shall put it in their hand and take it away. In other words, Ben-Hadad says, I'm not just interested in the deal here, X amount that you have to pay to get rid of me. I'm sending my servants down to search through the whole land of Israel, search through your homes, and anything of value, anything that's worth anything, they have full authority just to take and walk away with. In other words, this is a complete theft of everything valuable in the nation. This is a complete destruction of the sovereignty of the nation of Israel. It ceases to be a nation at this point. And Ahab realizes that if he gives in to this second request, he might as well not be king. There's nothing left to rule over. He's effectively the mayor of the parish of the nation of Israel now, controlled by the Syrians. And he has no power. He has no possessions that he can rebuild his kingdom, pay his army. He's finished as a king. And Ahab calls the elders of the nation, verse 7. He should have done this the first time. But being a proud, self-confident individual who has no regard for God, this time at least, he seeks the counsel of others. But again, notice the second time. He doesn't seek God. Doesn't ask Elijah or Elisha, is there anyone who knows the true God who can help us intervene in this terrible situation, this crisis? We're surrounded by this massive army, outnumbered nearly 20 to 1. They've got chariots, we don't. Is there anyone can help us? Anyone that can get in touch with God and seek God's help at this time? And after consulting with his elders, the elders say to him in verse 8, hearken not unto him, nor consent. Their advice, their considered advice is this. If you give in at this point, there's nothing left. We cease to be a nation. We might as well give up completely. Although he has the upper hand, there's nothing left to give. Now, Ahab decides he will do this. But he's very diplomatic in how he replies to Ben-Hadad. He says, verse 9, "Wherefore Ahab said unto the messengers of Ben-Hadad, Tell my lord the king all that thou didst send for to thy servant at the first I will do." So he tries a little bit of diplomacy. He says, everything you asked me the first time, we're happy to do. We'll give anything you want. Name your price and we'll pay it. But then he says, there's a little but. But this thing I may not do. The last thing you asked me, you can have Jezebel, no problem. Help yourself. You can have all the silver and the gold that you asked for, the price. But complete control of the nation, complete annihilation of the nation, I can't do. Because there's nothing left for me to rule over. That's basically what he's telling Ben-Hadad. Now, any time you tell a dictator and a tyrant and a self-centered, proud man like Ben-Hadad no, there's going to be problems. And there's going to be a reaction. And sure enough, Ahab has to expect there's trouble coming. Ben-Hadad is not a person that you say no to. Particularly, you say no to in public. Through diplomacy. Through the megaphone diplomacy of these messengers. And Ben-Hadad replies in verse 10. And here's his reply. "The gods do so unto me, and more also." And what does that expression mean? That expression is him taking an oath under his religious gods that he believes in. And he's really saying this, "I swear by my gods." So he's trying to make it very clear that what he's about to say, if he doesn't do it, let him be cursed by his gods. So it's a very strong statement. It's like a passing the law of the king. And he says, "The gods do to me, and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for all the people that follow me." He's really saying this. The Samaria, the city of Samaria, which was a beautiful city, we know from other writings that they had ivory palaces, beautiful homes made of cedar and ivory in the city of Samaria. And Ben-Hadad says, "I swear," and he's saying this publicly before all his vassal kings that are with him and all the soldiers that are with him. He's saying, "Tomorrow or the next day after this battle is over, all that will be left of Samaria is some dust. Because everybody from my army is just going to go in, destroy it, and take everything they want and leave it in as just a handful of dust. That's all. It will be nothing." So he's boasting. And he's proclaiming what's going to happen in the future. He's telling everybody, "I control the future. I'm Ben-Hadad, the great king of the Syrian Empire." Now, Ahab then responds. And we have to say there's some wisdom in the response of Ahab this time. We have an expression in English, "A broken clock is right twice a day." You ever notice that? And occasionally, even the wicked are correct in certain things that they say. And Ahab here gives a correct response because he says to this man, Ben-Hadad, tell him, this is my reply to him, "Tell him, let not him that girdeth on his harness boast himself as he that putteth it off." In other words, you don't boast before you put on your armor to go to battle. You only boast when you've won the battle and you're taking your armor off. That's what Ahab is saying. In other words, he's saying, don't count your chickens before they're hatched. That's really what he's saying. Don't be too presumptuous, Ben-Hadad. The battle hasn't even been fought yet. And you are assuming in your big talk that it's already over. There's an old saying in Mexico, And it's really repeated around the world down through the years when a nation faces annihilation, its sovereignty destroyed. And the Mexicans have a saying, better to die on your feet than to live on your knees. You understand what they're saying? Better to die on your feet. In other words, when it comes to a choice of complete annihilation of your sovereignty and your power and your dignity, it's better to face your enemy and die standing up than to cow and be humiliated on your feet, on your knees, and lose everything. And Ahab somehow, some way, when he faces this existential crisis, the very existence of his nation is under attack, and his kingdom and his reign as king is under attack. He finds some courage within himself. And he says to Ben-Hadad, maybe it's foolish, maybe it's rash, but he sparks a response in Ahab and he says, don't boast too quickly, Ben-Hadad. You haven't won the war yet. You haven't even put your armor on yet to go to battle. And don't talk as if the victory is already your victory. Now, how will Ben-Hadad respond to this insult? Verse 12. Aren't you glad there was no social media in those days? Can you imagine? There'll be a tremendous storm on Twitter and Facebook from Ahab and Ben-Hadad. Well, Ben-Hadad, he's drinking, we're told in verse 12. And alcohol and pride and violence are a very bad combination, aren't they? Always are. You even see these little videos going around Singapore, these silly people at the coffee shops drinking too much. And sure enough, the more bottles that go down their neck, the bigger they grow. They grow an extra inch every bottle they take. And then it's not long before the fists are flying. And the insults and the threats. And the little guy, who's about 1.6 meters, he fancies himself against the guy who's 2 meters. And he thinks he's bigger than him even. And here's Ben-Hadad. He's doing enough boasting before the drinking starts. And now the drinking has started. Well, he's even more proud. Even more boastful. And he calls his soldiers, verse 12, and he says, set yourselves in array. In other words, get ready for battle. Prepare the troops. Sharpen your swords. Get your chariots ready to roll. And they set themselves in array against the city. Now, Ahab, when he saw this, must have trembled more than a little. Because he has 7,000 soldiers outside the city of Samaria, surrounding him, is 127,000, at least 127, maybe more. How do we know there's 127,000? Well, because later on in this chapter, we're told they killed 127,000. So there's at least 127,000. There may have been 200,000 or 300,000, for all we know, outside the walls of Samaria. So here's Ahab with his tiny little group of soldiers, and he looks out over the walls of Samaria, and he sees a huge army with experienced warriors led by over 20 kings plus Ben-Hadad. These are experienced warriors. And here's Ahab pitting his wits, his tactical skills, against this large group of kings and leaders. That's very intimidating, isn't it? It's even more intimidating when they outnumber you about 20 to 1. Terrifying. And I'm sure Ahab was shaking in his shoes. And he must have wondered, what on earth did I do when I opened my big mouth and got into this argument with Ben-Hadad? What did I do wrong? I wish I hadn't said what I said about putting your armor on and off. I should have kept quiet. I should have tried to find a way to accommodate. But this situation where the odds are so heavily against Ahab and his army and his nation, God is going to use this particular incident to let you and I know that man doesn't rule the world. God's in charge. And he's going to demonstrate through this incident to Ahab and to his people and to us that only God is sovereign, not man. Only God is in control and not man. And God sends a prophet in verse 13 to Ahab. Now, we don't know his name. It doesn't seem to be Elijah or Elisha. It may have been one of the 7,000 who hadn't bowed the knee to Baal. It may have been one of the prophets of Obadiah that he hid in the cave. We just don't know. But this prophet is sent to Ahab with a message from the true God. And it's good news for Ahab. And the news is this. Thus saith the Lord. Verse 13. Hast thou seen all this great multitude? He says, do you not look outside the walls of your city and see this vast army? Don't worry about it, God says. Behold, I will deliver it into thine hand this day, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord. So God says, in mercy, in grace, to Ahab, although he doesn't deserve it, he fully deserves to be wiped out with Jezebel and all the rest of them. God says, in mercy, in grace, I will deliver you from this vast army that outnumbers you almost 20-1, that has chariots and you don't have. And I'm going to do it this day, and I'm going to do it to show you once again, like I did at Mount Carmel, that I am the true God. That Baal is not the true God. That the gods of Syria are not the true gods. That Jehovah is the true God of Israel. Now, why does God do this? Well, if you study world history, you'll grasp this reality. That companies rise and they what? Fall. Nations rise and they fall. Families rise and they fall. And why does God allow that? Because he wants you and I to know that man is not great. That man's wisdom is not great. And it's only by the grace of God that they can even sustain themselves for a very short moment, season, in this world. And only God ultimately is sovereign and in control. And he's saying the same to Ahab. He's saying the same to the nation of Israel. Now, I think also God may be showing grace to Elijah and Elisha and the believers. Remember, there are 7,000 in the nation who did not bow the knee. There are many others who probably have joined them now. Many others who at Mount Carmel cried, "The Lord, Jehovah, he is the true God." And because they are God's people in that nation, in spite of the wickedness of the leadership of that nation, God is going to show mercy and grace to this nation of Israel. He has not finished with Elijah. He is not finished with Elisha. He has a ministry for them to do. And Ahab, verse 14, recognizes that this prophet is bringing a word from the Lord. And here's the amazing thing in Ahab. Many times God shows great mercy and great power to him. And Ahab acknowledges it. You notice he doesn't say, "Well, I don't believe you," when this prophet speaks. He straight away, Ahab recognizes there's truth here. This is God talking to me. And here's one of the great tragedies in Ahab's life. In fact, in many people's lives. They recognize God is at work in their lives. They recognize God even talks to them. Maybe they have a Christian spouse or a Christian relative that witnesses to them. And they fully accept that God is in control. But yet, when it comes to the message of the gospel, they just walk away. They keep going their own path. That's one of the great tragedies of the life of Ahab. God shows him so much, and yet he turns his back on God in the end every time. But Ahab here, he recognizes this is God, and he says straight away, "By whom? What do I do? How do I handle this guy?" And he's told this very unlikely advice. He says, "Thus saith the Lord," the prophet tells him, verse 14, "even by the young men of the princes of the province." In other words, who are the young men? They seem to be the inexperienced warriors, the civil servants. Here in Singapore, we would call them the government scholars. just graduated from university and joined the government scholarship program. Soft hands, no experience. And God says to Ahab, these group of young men, 232 of them, the most unlikely ones to lead your army, they are to go out and fight against this man Ben-Hadad and his mighty army. So this is very strange advice by God. But you notice Ahab doesn't argue. He doesn't say, this is foolishness, this is crazy. Ahab is in a crisis. He's in the worst crisis of his life, and he's panicking, and he needs God's help. And he then says, the next question, verse 14, who shall order the battle? In other words, what is the strategy going to be? I send out these 232 scholars, civil servants, to face Ben-Hadad. But what else should I do? What tactics should I use? I have 7,000 troops. What to do? Who's going to lead them? And God's simple reply is, you, Ahab. You organize an ambush behind them. You come up with a tactical system to fight against the Syrians behind them. I'm not going to help you anymore. And here's what's amazing in this story. The proud, self-confident man called Ahab follows God's advice. Because we're told in verse 15, then he numbered the young men of the princes of the provinces. So Ahab says, okay. It may appear to be a suicide mission. It may appear to be a crazy strategy to send out these 232 young, inexperienced men, civil servants, to face Ben-Hadad. But God says it. I don't have any other strategy. I don't have any other way of dealing with this situation. I'm at a loss. So let me just go with it. We might as well try this. Now notice, when Ahab does all of this, he doesn't pray. He doesn't seek God's help. He doesn't repent in any way of his sin. He doesn't say, well, I was wrong the first time to not acknowledge God in the first place. That doesn't bother Ahab. He's somebody who just wants to get out of the problem. And there are many people like that. I preached a message not long ago in the other place, Foxhole Religion. Do you remember it? How there are people who always come to God when they're in the foxhole, in the problem, fallen into the crisis. And they want God's help. And I get them all the time. I get messages on Facebook sent to me. I get WhatsApp messages come through to me regularly from people who are not connected to this church in any way. And they say, Pastor, can you pray for me? I've got a problem. I've lost my job. I've got a bad diagnosis from the doctor. I'm not a churchgoer. I don't belong to any organized Christian group, but I need help. And sometimes you feel like saying, why did it take you so long to find God and seek God? But the only reason they're contacting you is they've tried everything else and it doesn't work. And now they think this is the last throw of the dice. Well, we'll try God in this situation. And you know, there are even professing Christians who do the same, who try every other method. And then when they've exhausted every situation, every possible aid, then they come and they say, well, maybe we'll give God a shot. See if he can help me out in this situation. And Ahab's kind of like that. He's at the bottom of the barrel. He's exhausted every possible human way of dealing with the situation. He himself has no idea what to do. And God now says, send out the civil servants to show how great I am, how much I control everything, to magnify my glory in dealing with these Syrians and their mighty army. And Ahab says, okay, let's give it a go. Give it a whirl. Nothing to lose. Last throw of the dice. And he organizes his young men, 230 odd of them, and he sends them out to face Ben-Hadad. And as they leave, we're told in verse 17, Ben-Hadad, well, verse 16 and 17 tells us, the 32 kings that make up the army of Ben-Hadad are drinking in the tents. The party's full on. They think the battle is already won. No need to even worry about this enemy called Ahab and his armies, because they're worth nothing. They'll just squash them. And the drink is in full flow, as if the battle has already been fought. And no doubt the alcohol is going to impair their judgment. Because when the 232 civil servants walked towards the armies of Ben-Hadad, the tents of Ben-Hadad, the word comes to the king and is told, verse 17, there are men come out of Samaria. What will Ben-Hadad do? He says, verse 18, this is his instructions, whether they be come out for peace, take them alive. Or whether they be come out for war, take them alive. In other words, he says, they don't look like soldiers. But whatever their motive, they probably come to plead for mercy, plead for some diplomatic situation. After all, I've already won the battle. They're probably trying to get a job in the new regime. He says, no matter what their motive is, maybe they're suicides, they want to actually try and attack. He says, just capture them. We'll humiliate them and use them. So self-confident is he as he faces this little group of civil servants, 200 of them coming towards his tents. He doesn't take them seriously as a force. And because he doesn't take them seriously, and because he tells his army not to take them seriously, everybody's relaxed. Nobody's ready for an attack. And behind the 232, Ahab sends his 7,000 troops as an ambush. And when Ben-Hadad is relaxed and waiting, God is going to use this incident for this tiny force of Ahab to overwhelm the great force of Ben-Hadad. Because what happens if you let a small group get close to a large group? Then the advantages of the large group dissipate. You can't step back and fire your arrows from a distance. You can't use the chariots from a distance to scatter the small force. So by allowing the small group right up close to the armies of Ben-Hadad, it makes Ben-Hadad very vulnerable and his army very vulnerable to being beaten and attacked by a much smaller force who are disciplined and fighting for their lives. And who are ready to fight. And that's exactly what happened in this story. Ben-Hadad keeps the booze flowing. And he's enjoying the party. And his men relax at the perimeter of the camp. And they see this tiny group come towards him, probably not even dressed in armor. And as they come closer, they just say, well, they're coming to surrender. They've come to acknowledge how great we are. And to their shock, and then to their horror, this small group suddenly attacks. And then from the small group, suddenly emerges a much larger group, 7,000. And they join in and split the forces of Ben-Hadad and catch them unawares. And all the advantages they had in numbers, all their communications and their logistics and their discipline, completely falls apart in the panic, in the mayhem that follows. And we're told, when that happens, verse 20, they slew everyone his man, and the Syrians fled. And Israel pursued them, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, escaped on horse with the horsemen. And the king of Israel went out and smote the horses and the chariots and slew the Syrians with a great slaughter. Just as God said would happen that day, happened. The much smaller army, the much more insignificant army, was able to destroy this great army of the Syrians and destroy their chariots and their horses. And despite the great disparity in numbers, God enabled the small group to overwhelm the great group. And as I said earlier, God often does that. Often does that. Have you noticed no empire stays an empire for too long? We talk about the superpowers. When I was a boy, there was this Iron Curtain that bisected the European continent. And on one side, we had the USSR, on one side of the Iron Curtain, with all their weaponry and their armies. And on the other side, you had all the forces of NATO, plus the United States. And it was seen as a war that, if it broke out, would destroy everything. And the USSR seemed impregnable, impossible. In fact, when I was a boy, the churches in Ireland used to raise money to send Bibles to smuggle them in to Romania and Hungary and Russia itself to provide literature for Christians who were suffering for their faith, who were jailed for the faith. Some even died for the faith. And it seemed, from a human perspective, that the USSR would go on forever. But yet when we switched on our television set one day, in the late 80s, 90s, what happened? The wall that was the symbol of the division in Berlin came what? Crumbling down. And it didn't come crumbling down through an army. It just fell down. The people knocked it down. And those who were in power in those countries, like Romania and Hungary and in Poland and East Germany, their power was swept away in just a matter of days. Some of them were put to death in the most public way, like the Ceausescu's in Romania. It all just happened in a moment of time. And it was a very stark reminder that what may appear strong today may not be so strong tomorrow. And we're seeing it right now in the world, aren't we? The swirl of the rise and fall of the nations. And everybody's jockeying for position and trying to see what way the wind is blowing. Who's going to emerge out of all this stronger? And the small nations are trying to build relationship with the more powerful ones that they think will emerge. God often allows that. In fact, not often, God always seems to work that way. To let us know that man comes and man goes. Man's kingdoms come and go. But only God's kingdom ultimately remains. And to teach you and I, don't get too fixated on the big corporations, the big tycoons, the big superpowers. Because only God rules this universe. No one and no one else. Many years ago, there was a little man less than 5 feet tall called Napoleon. I'm sure you've heard of him. And Napoleon was highly successful as a military and political leader. And he swept through Europe and established the Napoleonic Empire. Conquered many nations. And one day, Napoleon came to the edge of Western Europe, or Eastern Europe, to the Russian border with his troops. And a friend of his who was talking to him said this: man proposes, but God disposes. In other words, he says, man plans, but only God decides. That's another way of saying it. Man proposes, but God disposes. God decides. Napoleon got very angry when he heard that, because he had become so self-confident with all the victories in conquering all the nations that he looked at his friend and he said angrily to him, I propose and I dispose. I decide. And it said from that moment onwards, the power of Napoleon started to wane. And he started to suffer defeats. And the Russians ultimately became the source of his first great defeat and conquest. Until the point where Napoleon was arrested by the British and sent off to exile to live the rest of his days as a prisoner. A nobody. The great Napoleon. And he discovered the hard way that only God decides who rules the world. Not Napoleon. Only God is in charge of the world. The ancient Romans had wisdom in how they handle victories. Because when a general conquered another nation in battle and achieved a great victory for the Roman Empire, they were given a victory parade in the city of Rome. A great honor. What would happen would be all the citizens of the city would gather, and the general would come in with his troops, and all the citizens would applaud them and throw flowers and utter great statements of congratulations. And the Senate, in the center of the HQ of Rome, they would gather to applaud the great military victory by this general. But as the parade went through the city of Rome, the ancient Romans had some wisdom, because they ordered every general, as he came in on his chariot to receive all the accolades, they would always order one slave to be in the chariot with him. And the slave's job, as he would go through the city of Rome, hearing all the applause and all the congratulations, and of course the tendency to become puffed up with pride, the slave's job was to whisper constantly into his ear, "Remember, you are only mortal. Remember, you are only mortal." And he was told that all the way through, lest he got carried away with the victory and the celebration and the congratulations. And let me say this as we close today. Life has many ups and downs. Be prepared for that. God raises up, but God also brings down people. And that is true for the Christian as well as for the unbeliever. Many years ago, I was watching a program just the other day. A Jewish family came from Eastern Europe with nothing, fleeing persecution and poverty. And they began a little business in London, selling tobacco. Then he decided to reach out a little bit and start selling tea and cakes. And they started a little tea shop at the turn of the 20th century. Eventually it grew and grew and grew and became the largest tea and cake shop in all of the UK, called Lion's Tea and Lion's Cakes. They employed 30,000 people working for them. They were like the Starbucks of the turn of the 20th century. Everywhere. They had shops everywhere. And a young girl living in Grantham in Lincolnshire, in the northeast coast of England, who was studying at university or studying at school and hoping to go to university, she got a job as a waitress working for them. Her name was Margaret Roberts, just a young girl. And she worked as a waitress for Lion's Tea Shop in her hometown. Just an employee. Just a waitress. Oh, they were very rich. They owned a massive hotel. They owned grand homes, the Lyons family that owned the business. They became the multimillionaires, billionaires of their day. And Margaret Roberts worked for a few pence as a waitress. But many years later, 40 years later, that young girl who was a waitress in their shop became Margaret Thatcher after she got married, graduated from Oxford University, and eventually became Prime Minister. And when she became Prime Minister, the Lion's Tea Shop went bankrupt because of mismanagement. They got themselves in debt. And all the business was sold off. And into the parliament that she controlled, a new MP arrived called Nigel Lawson. You probably heard of his daughter Nigella Lawson, the chef. She's famous for her cookery books. Nigel Lawson was the grandson of the founder of Lion's Tea Shop. And Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, appointed him to become her Chancellor of the Exchequer, the head of the finance of the UK. And as I was watching it was just a reminder of how quickly things can turn around, can't it? The one who worked for the master one day, a few years later, became the master over the master. And when they went down, she went up. And instead of them appointing her, she now appoints their children, their grandchildren, to positions of influence in the society. And how quickly things can change. We need to be aware of that in our lives. Don't get too full of ourselves. Don't get too self-confident. Life has many ups and downs. Many a person gets up in the morning with great plans and never makes it to the sunset that day. On the way here this morning, I drove up the AYE. And then I came off at the exit of the CTE called Clement Chew Road. I'm sure you know the name. It's not a Singaporean name, is it? Clement Chew. Where did it come from? It came from one of the great French leaders, a man called George Clement Chew, who fought in World War I. And because he fought so successfully for the French people, they made him the Premier of France. And he came to Singapore on a tour after World War I was over. And he visited just over here, the Esplanade, to visit the war memorial of those who had died in World War I. And the government at the time said, "We would like to honor you, George Clement Chew. Would you mind if we named a road after you to honor your great achievements in fighting for the peace of the world in World War I?" And he gave his consent. But you know, George Clement Chew got old, like everybody else. And as he got old, he got frail. And as he began to face death, he ordered his own grave to be dug, a hole in the ground. And one day he was walking past the grave that was prepared for him. And he said to his aide who was helping him walk past, he says, "Take a look at the hole." And he says, "There in a nutshell is all you can say about me. A hole in the ground and a great deal of noise about nothing." That's how he described his life. Great deal of noise about nothing. Today, most people who drive up that Clement Chew Road have no idea who the person is. Most of us can't even pronounce the name of it. Never mind work out who is the person it represents. Because what is it a reminder of? People come and people go. Who may be great today is not great tomorrow. Success is transient. The applause of this world is transient. And of course, the opposite is true as well. God can take a person who is nothing today and make something of their lives tomorrow. Joseph woke up in prison one morning in Egypt, had his breakfast, and got up, and it was just going to be like any other day. Boring, mundane, restricted in this awful prison. And little did he know, by the end of that day, that he would be standing in the palace of Pharaoh in new clothes with a gold ring and a chain, and that he would become the prime minister of the world's greatest empire. And it all happened in less than 24 hours. God has this ability to bring up and to bring down. And he has been doing this all through the years, all through the centuries, to remind you and I and I alone rule this world. I'm in charge. Don't get too caught up with your own talents and plans and abilities. And God alone can do this. And what he's saying to you and I this morning is this, that God isn't limited to what we think he can do. He's saying to you and I, let me fill the blanks in your life of tomorrow. Don't get carried away with yourself. Someone put it in this very blunt way. They said, write your plans in pencil. Leave God the eraser to rub them out when he wants to. This is God's world. We live in a time of great confusion. And people are saying to me, what's going to happen? And here's the simple answer. I don't know. I don't know. But I do know one who does know. I do know one that if you look up, you'll see him on the throne. And he alone, not big tech, not some big corporation, not some superpower, he and he alone will decide the future of this world. He and he alone will decide your future and my future. And today we come together to say, not my kingdom, but as what Jesus taught his disciples to pray, our Father, which art in heaven, thy kingdom come. You rule the world. Let us pray. Father, we thank thee for this thy word this morning that reminds us that man makes all his plans, man has all his pride, but ultimately God decides. Bless us now as we leave this place. Give us confidence, not in ourselves, not in our circumstances, but in the God who controls the circumstances. For we ask these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.